the topic for this evening is Jews in foreign palaces. Yosef, Daniel, and Esther. Joseph, Daniel, and Esther. And the three stories have striking similarities. To review briefly, Joseph is sold by his brothers. He initially is sold as a servant. He is a servant in the household of Potiphar. There's an accusation involving Potiphar's wife, and then he goes to jail. And then from there, he rises to a position of power. We'll get into more details later. Daniel is taken captive as a young man by the Babylonians in the beginning of the book of Daniel. And he, too, rises to a position of power. He is a court Jew, initially, being trained for standing in the court and looking like a fine Jewish captive who has become Babylonian. We'll talk more about that as well. And then he rises to a position of power. And Esther, of course, goes to the palace as queen in name, but not in role. What she really is she's being brought in for the harem. As a matter of fact, there's a whole theory that I'm not going to get into tonight behind the book of Esther, in which Esther is chosen specifically because she has a no-name background, because she doesn't have any nobility to her. And Ahasuerus will not feel threatened. He doesn't worry that this peasant girl is going to be a threat to him, and that's why he picks her. But then she, too, comes into a position of power. So in all three of the stories, we have Jews who are put into a royal situation in a position of inferiority, but they grow into authority. And the goal that I want to pursue here is to look for similarities in their stories and in their messages, because we have a principle, Talmudically, that when the sages sat down and canonized and said, these texts are going to be Tanakh, these are going to be the biblical text, they chose texts that they felt would have relevant practical messages for Jews for all time. It wasn't simply a matter of, this is an interesting story, and therefore we should make sure that people read it, but actually it had messages. Thank you so much. So, with that in mind, and now that we have the sheets, courtesy of Abby, we can get into it for real. Please do. We have enough now, you can take more than one if you like. Beginning by looking at the verses themselves and similarities in the way that the figures are presented. If you take a look at source number one, you find that all three of our protagonists are described as being attractive and with the same language. So that you find in the first listing there, Bereishit, Genesis 39:6, Vayehi Yosef yifei toar v'yifei mareh, Joseph was of pleasant form and pleasant appearance. That's Joseph when he's in the house of Potiphar. Daniel is described as tovei mareh, of good appearance. That's actually why he is selected for his role as a court Jew, because he is somebody who is of good appearance and he'll look good in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar the Babylonian. And Esther is described as Vahanara Yifat Toar Vitovat Mareh, of pleasant form and of good appearance. But it goes beyond that in the Midrash regarding their beauty. If you take a look at source number two, this is a Midrash on a verse from Birkat Kohanim, the blessing that the Kohanim give to the Jews. The last word in the second line of this three-line blessing is vichuneka, that God should give you chen. Chen, I translate it as favor. It's not a word that really admits of a direct one-word English translation. I've seen it rendered as favor, grace, charm. None of those really capture it. The translation for chen is chen. Nonetheless, doing our best, the Midrash on that says, Yitain cheincha be'enei abriyot, that God will give you favor in the eyes of his creations, that others should look upon you favorably. And the Midrash notes regarding Joseph, God was with Joseph, v'yeshem et Yosef, v'yitain chino be'enei sar beit hasohar, that he gave Joseph's chen in the eyes of the officer of the prison. And then with Esther, Vati Esther noseit chein be'enei kol ro'eha, she found favor, she was favorable in the eyes of all those who saw her. And sure enough, with Daniel, Vayitein ha'lokim et Daniel lechein ulocheser ulrachamim, God gave Daniel favor, kindness, and mercy. All three of them are biblically described this way, and the sages picked up on it and said, aha, there's something going on here, this is a set. There's more in terms of the common denominators. All three of them have, as we've said, involvement with kings. And their kings share traits. All three of them have kings who display a measure of arrogance, whether we're talking about the Pharaoh in Joseph's story, or we're talking about King Ahasuerus in his parties and his relationship with Vashti, or you're talking about Nebuchadnezzar, who frankly spends the first four chapters of the book of Daniel first becoming arrogant and then becoming humbled. But all of them relate to kings who are arrogant and must be humbled. So in terms of the characters in the stories, there are similarities. But more than that, there are basic plot elements that are the same. How does God intervene in the story of Joseph? What is God's mechanism? Dreams, right? The dreams of the butler and the baker, and then the dreams of the king, of the Pharaoh. Move into the story of Daniel, and how does God elevate Daniel to power? You have to know the book of Daniel. That's harder. King Nebuchadnezzar has dreams. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is a wickedly cruel man, so actually when you read the book, it's kind of scary. He has dreams, and they're frightening dreams for him, and so he wakes up and he calls his advisors, and he says to the advisors, explain to me what my dream was, and what it meant. And they look at him and they say, no one can do that. To tell you what you dreamed and what it meant, that's unheard of. And he says, well, you have two choices. You could tell me what it was and what it meant, or I cut you up into little pieces. That's quite literally what he says. And they're about to be chopped up until Daniel comes along and he explains the dream. The Nebuchadnezzar is a brutal, beastly human being. So in that story, again, God acts through dreams. And then, of course, in the Purim story, how does God intervene? How does God move things along? Not dreams, but
the king dreams.
Well, he doesn't dream. He can't sleep. Right? God is manipulating sleep patterns. With the king there, with Ahasuerus, he can't sleep. I had a theory that the reason why God doesn't send Ahasuerus a dream is because he's not worthy. When you look at the way Ahasuerus is depicted by the sages, building on verses in the book of Esther itself, he's really depicted as being this very uncouth person, you know, with this 180-day party, with, you know, excessive alcohol, the whole bit. The way that he gives in to his every whim and he executes his wife because she won't show up for him at the party. This is not someone who's even worthy of God sending him a dream, let alone prophecy, but even a dream. Like, Pharaoh is better, and Nebuchadnezzar is better than Ahasuerus. That shows up in multiple ways with him. It's not just in this sense. In the way that King Nebuchadnezzar is the Babylonian king who destroys the first temple. He takes the vessels from the temple, and he puts them into the space of his idols, into his temple, to be stored along with the vessels of his idol. Which, even though we don't like it, at least he's treating them with respect. What does the Midrash say in the beginning of the book of Esther in terms of the vessels he uses at Ahasuerus uses at his party? He uses the vessels from the Beit HaMikdash, from the temple. He's using them to drink from, which is modeled on a story from the book of Daniel with a king named Belshazzar. But the point is that Ahasuerus is depicted as this person with nothing to recommend him. He's not worthy of a dream, so God will instead intervene by disturbing his sleep, but not actually sending him a message. He's not worthy of a message. More in terms of common plot elements between them, all three stories hinge upon anger. Right? Where's the anger in the Joseph story?
Oh, Potiphar's wife, I guess, put Joseph in jail for his wife, because he wouldn't be with her.
Right. When Potiphar's wife tells Potiphar what had happened, Potiphar gets very angry and puts him in jail. Good. Where else? There's anger throughout the story. I mean, there's
Being angry at the butcher.
Right. Paro getting angry at the butler and the baker. Right. Paro katsafa lavadav. That's how the whole story begins there of his climb. Well, there's one other element which we'll get back to later, but he climbs out as a result of Paro's anger at the butler and the baker. Frankly, he also ends up in jail because his brothers got angry at him and sold him down, you know, in the first place. The story hinges on anger, and then in the Purim story as well, where do we find anger? Haman gets angry. Achashverosh gets angry at Haman as well. And Bigtan and Teresh get angry at Achashverosh. I'm using these in particular because the text actually invokes their anger as a key element in the story. Katsaf, Bigtan, Vateresh. They got angry, and as a result, what ended up happening? They plotted against Achashverosh. Mordechai found out, right? And as a result of that, he conveys the news to Achashverosh. Achashverosh is now in his debt, and he is elevated. He gets the parade throughout the city. That drives Haman over the edge in terms of his anger. It's step by step within this, it's about anger. And then, by the way, if you take a look at source number 3, the Midrash picks up on these connections, the anger connections between those two. The Midrash does not pick up on source number 4, which is the verse in Daniel, in which we find that the king Nebuchadnezzar gets angry at his sages and says he's going to destroy them because they can't interpret his dreams. So anger plays a key role in that story as well.
It causes people's demise and it also saves them.
Yes, absolutely. The Joseph and Daniel are both saved from pits, as noted in the Midrash in source number 5. All three of our figures are given royal clothing. Right? Joseph is paraded out in the city with his new name of Tzachnat Paneach, wearing royal clothing. Daniel is given royal clothing by the king as well. And of course, Mordechai goes on his parade wearing the royal garb that's described in the Megillah. All three of them are given royal clothing. So not only are there constants in the personalities involved, there are constants in terms of the plot elements and more. All three of them perform similar actions. Or at least two of them. It's not true across the board for all of these. But Joseph and Daniel both interpret dreams. All three of them save the Jews from a threat. All three of them act to save either the king or the empire. There are common denominators between their actions too. And there is a lot of similar language. And here I'm not going to go through the whole thing. But take a look at source number 7. The Hebrew is on the first side. The English runs over onto the second side. The Midrash picks up here on common language between the stories of Joseph and the story of Joseph and the story of Esther. Over and over again, there are parallelisms in the language. Beyond even this, beyond the constants in the personalities, beyond the constants in terms of the plot elements, beyond the constants in terms of their actions and the language that's used, the teachings of our sages make these links even stronger. What did Esther eat in the palace of Ahasuerus? Do you know?
Kosher food.
One would hope. But seriously, have you ever heard anything about it? Chickpeas. Close. Close. Very close. The Midrash, act well, let me ask the question differently. What's the origin of Hamantashen?
Well, it depends on
the hat.
Either it's the hat, Haman's hat.
Right, because Haman was an American colonist. He had a three-cornered hat.
Well, some would say it's just the Yiddish montash, which is a pocket of...
A pocket holding.
Poppy seed.
Bingo. The pocket holding mun, which is indeed poppy seeds. Correct. Not the original mun in the desert, but mun is a term for poppy seeds. And according to the Talmud, that's what Esther ate in the palace. That Esther ate... poppy seeds. What am I talking about? Where is he getting this from? Take a look at source number 8. A passage in the Talmud. There's a verse in the book of Esther which says, Vayishaneha ve'es na'arosel letov beis hanashim, that he, the person in charge of the women during this beauty pageant, he altered her and her maids to give Esther the best in the women's residence. So the Talmud asks, what does that mean? What did he alter to give her the best? So Amar Rav said in source number 8, Sheha'echila ma'achal Yehudi. Rav says he gave her kosher food. I'm assuming Yehudi doesn't mean kosher style. He gave her deli, you know, Eastern European, whatever. No. But he's giving her Jewish food, meaning kosher food. Ushmuel Amar. Shmuel disagrees and says, Sheha'echila kadle de chaziri. he gave her kadli de chaziri. That's a hard phrase to translate. Onkelos, the Aramaic commentator to the Torah, translates am kishe oref, a stiff-necked people, as am kishe kedal. Kedal is the oref, the back of the neck. So kadli de chaziri, chaziri, chazir, pig. So it's the back of the necks of pigs. That's one explanation. I should note there's an alternative explanation, which notes that we also have the word chazeret, which is lettuce, and suggests that it's actually lettuce, which was a delicacy. If you could get lettuce, that was a fine thing, and that this was what he was giving her. That's nicer than, you know, pork rinds. But Shmuel gives his answer, and then Rabbi Yochanan says, zer onim. He gave her zer onim, which are seeds. Well, that's an odd idea. Why seeds? Where do you get seeds from that she ate seeds? And sure enough, he quotes, you take a look, he quotes a verse from Daniel about the food that Daniel had. You see, in the beginning of the book of Esther, or the book of Daniel, I should say, Daniel and other Jewish youths are taken to the palace, and they're to be trained, as I said, to be court Jews in the Babylonian court. They're going to stand there and be signs of the captured Jews. And as part of that, they're to be fattened up with what's called patibaga of the king. Patbag is the term that's used in the book of Daniel. Patibaga is a Persian term, and it refers to food from the king's table. They're going to get food from the king's table. Daniel and his friends say, we don't want the food from the king's table. Thank you very much, we're vegetarian. They say, we would like to have seeds. Why they say that is something we're going to come back to. But they refuse the food. And the king's officer says, I can't do that. Because if you show up scrawny in the court, they're going to have my head. And remember, Nebuchadnezzar is the last human being on earth you want to cross. You don't get Nebuchadnezzar upset and live to tell the story. So he says, there's no way in the world that I'm going to do this. And so they go to somebody else, known in the book of Daniel as Hamelzar. Hamelzar does not mean the waiter. Even though Melzar has come to mean that, as I've read it, the story of this word Hamelzar is actually that Hamelzar is likely the person's name. But Jews later reading it recognize the hey in the beginning of the word as the definite object, the Meltzar. So he must be the person who brings the food. Meltzar is the person who brings your food. Meltzar is therefore a waiter. But in any case, that's a side note, linguistic trivia. But the point is they go to the waiter and say, listen, you can keep the king's food if you just give us seeds. And he says, again, I'll get in trouble. And they say, give us a trial period of 10 days. See how we do. And for 10 days, they're eating their seeds instead on their vegetarian diet. And lo and behold, at the end of 10 days, as the first chapter in Daniel says, they're healthier than everybody else. Interestingly, the commentators on that dispute whether this is a miracle or whether this is actually the natural consequence of a vegetarian diet. They actually will be healthier and you'll look better when you're vegetarian. Several of the commentators, Ibn Ezra, Barbanel, contend that a vegetarian diet is healthier. But in terms of this particular story, they decline the food from the king's table. They instead take the seeds, and the Talmud borrows from that, the verse from Daniel, to say, yeah, that's what Esther did. She ate seeds just like Daniel did. And that's my point in bringing this, is to show the connection between the stories. The Talmud is making a bridge for us to be able to see that. Whether that's really the origin of Hamantashen or whether that was a food that we enjoyed and then we grafted the story into the story existed separately in the Talmud and people were eating Hamantashen separately and someone said, hey, maybe one is connected to the other. That could also be the origin. I have no idea. But the point is that we link the two stories so much so, it's very funny. In the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in Krakow in the 16th century, quotes the practice of eating Hamantashen on Purim. He talks about eating Zeronim, eating seeds. And he says, we eat these to remember Daniel. And commentators on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, look at him and say, then why are we doing this on Purim? It's to remember Esther. What do you mean to remember Daniel? But the answer is, he remembers that the whole Esther piece of it came from Daniel. It was ported over into Esther's story. Okay. That's one example of how the sages made the story stronger, made the connection stronger. Another example, if you take a look at source number 9, Daniel is a descendant of Yehuda, fourth son of Jacob. The one who also nearly got Tamar and her two children who were inside of her at the time killed, but then he saved their lives. So that's what this midrash picks up on. And it says in source number 9, because Yehuda merited and he saved Tamar and her two sons from death, and he also saved Joseph. He saved Joseph from death because Joseph is going to be killed. And then he says, no, throw him in the pit and we'll sell him and so on. He says, he doesn't say throw him in the pit. He says, take him out of the pit and sell him. So as a result of that, God saved four of his descendants. He saved Tamar, her two kids, Peretz and Zerah, and Joseph. He saved four. So God saves four of his descendants. Daniel, parallel to Joseph. And then also Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel's friends in the court, are saved parallel to the other three who were saved. But Daniel and Joseph are then linked by the Midrash. If you take a look at source number 10, Midrash on the book of Esther. If you remember when Zeresh, the wife of Haman, says to Haman, you know, if this guy Mordechai is from the Jews, it's not going to work. You've begun to fall before him. You're going to fall all the way before him. You don't have a chance against him. So the Midrash picks up on that and says that Zeresh actually says, if he's a Jew, there's no way you can defeat him. Because if you throw him into a furnace, too late. The friends of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, already saved from a furnace. You throw him into a den of lions, Daniel already escaped from there. Imprison him. Joseph got out of jail. It's very interesting to imagine Zeresh actually giving this speech to Haman, but that's not really the point that I want to bring out here. The point that I want to bring here is, again, they're linking stories here for us, they're trying to tell us something. They're trying to tell us, see all the common denominators that exist between these. They're meant to be associated. There's more. Daniel disappears mysteriously at the end of the book of Daniel. The book is 12 chapters long. At the end of the book, there's a prophecy. The prophecy ends, and the book is over. We don't find out what happened to him. And so the sages dispute what happens to Daniel after the book of Daniel. And one view is that he was actually reduced from his position of power in the royal court. There was a lot of jealousy of him that's already recorded within the book. How there are people who are sniping at him and who are jealous of what he has accomplished and so on. And he ends up becoming a servant in the palace instead. And according to the Talmud, he is Hatach, one of the servants in the story of Esther. He's the one who communicates messages between Mordechai and Esther. There's so much more that we could do with this, but I hope that I've succeeded in making the point that there are links all over the place between these three. The sages are trying to call our attention to it, and now what I want to move to is the question of, now what? We've established that we have three Jews who are in foreign palaces who have an awful lot in common with each other. But is there anything that we can learn from what they did? Is there some behavior that they exhibited that is important for us? Because in a strong way, we are Jews in foreign palaces, in the sense that Jews living in North America have greater influence in what goes on in their governments as a nation than Jews have had in a very, very long time. Maybe there have been individual Jews who were close with government over the centuries, but for the Jewish community as a whole to be so valued, I'm guessing now, I'm not a professional historian, I'd like to read it, but I don't, you know, I could be wrong, but I'm guessing the last time that you saw the Jewish community valued so highly is probably Turkey at the end of the 15th century, beginning of the 16th century. At a time when we've been kicked out of Spain and Portugal, and the Sultan opens up his borders and says, please, all Jews come here, because he recognizes the economic benefits of welcoming in the Jewish community. It may be that far back.
Again, Spain itself.
Right, well, Spain would have been earlier. I'm just trying to think, has there been anything since then?
Poland.
Or Iraq.
Poland on and off, but in recent history?
Yeah, like in the last few hundred years, yeah. But when they were invited, you know, obviously we know what happened in the end, but there were times when they were, I don't remember.
But I'm looking for more than being invited. I'm looking for the community having an influence.
There was a huge...
I think so.
I don't know.
The administrative class in Iraq. Mm-hmm. In the 20s and into the 30s.
Yeah.
It was predominantly Jewish.
So they would have been influential within, you know, influential with the government. Could be. Okay. So whether this is in fact as rare as I think it is or whether I'm entirely deluded doesn't change the point. The point that I'm making is when you have the ear of the king, when you are in the foreign palace, what are you supposed to do? What can we learn from the way they conducted themselves? That to me is a very important question. And I see four lessons that we can learn from their experience and from their actions. The first is emunah, faith. Meaning that even though we are in the foreign palace, we turn to God. We find with Daniel and Esther that they place an emphasis on prayer. We don't ever see Joseph pray. That's not something that's ever presented. But with Daniel and Esther, we find prayer. Daniel prays multiple times. As a matter of fact, he is the earliest source that we have, documented source, for a Jew praying three times a day. The Talmud says that we know to pray three times a day from one of two sources, either because the temple sacrifices were brought in the morning and the afternoon, and then the parts of the offering that were supposed to go on the altar were brought on the altar at night. But that doesn't talk about personal prayer. That's talking about the rituals of sacrifice. It also says that we know the Torah describes Abraham rising to talk to God in the morning. And we know that there's a description of Yitzchak, Isaac, going out to the field to speak in the afternoon. And Jacob, encounters God, has his dream, you know, at a site that we identify with the Beis HaMikdash, with the temple in the evening. But we don't get a description of someone praying three times a day. With Daniel, he actually gets in trouble for this, but he goes to his room and he turns to his window and he prays facing Jerusalem, and the text says, as he had done before he was taken captive, praying three times each day. That's the first documented location of somebody praying three times a day in Tanakh. And Esther, of course, when she is told to go to the king, she says the Jews should declare a fast, right? And I'm assuming, and I'm not the only one who assumes, that declaring a fast doesn't simply mean so they won't eat and they won't drink. It also implies a form of prayer to God going along with that. She says, "Vitzumu alai, fast for me. Val tochlu val tishtu shloshet yamim laila vayom. Don't eat, don't drink 3 days, night and day. V'gamani v'naro tayatzum kain. And I and my maids, we will fast as well." And then she goes on to say, "Yevachena v'ol hamelach hasher lo chadat v'hasher avadati avadati." She said, "Then I'll go to the king, even though it's against protocol. And if I'm lost, well, so be it." She doesn't actually mention the word prayer. It's an extrapolation. The assumption is prayer has historically meant. Fasting has historically meant fasting and praying. So that's the assumption. We also find that Joseph and Daniel both attribute their success to God. Right? When the king says, "I've heard you know how to interpret dreams," Joseph says, "Halo lelo kim pitronim." He says, the explanations of dreams belong to God. He attributes his success to God. And Daniel does the same. Every time that he interprets a dream, he says, "God has told me. This is from God." So that's first. Second is to retain a Jewish identity. They're going to try to make you blend in, but it's up to you to keep your identity. And that is huge. Is Joseph known by the name of Joseph in Egypt? No. What name do they give him? Safnat Paneach. Leave aside the question of whether that's actually Egyptian. That's actually a problem name. But they give him a name that is clearly meant to reflect his role within the palace as Pharaoh's dream interpreter. Tzafna Paneach is supposed to mean the one who sees that which is hidden. Tzafna, like Tzafun, at the Seder, right? When you take that Bikomen out of hiding. The Tzafna Paneach, the one who reads the dreams, who sees that which is hidden. Daniel is not known as Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar and his court. They rename him, and they rename his friends. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, names which at least two of them are associated with Babylonian gods, and Daniel himself is renamed Belteshazzar, off of Baal, a Babylonian god as well. Belteshazzar is the king who is son or grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, but it's a play off of that same. Belteshazzar means Baal should guard him. Belteshazzar is some variation, but it's the same idea, that he's being given a Babylonian name. And then, of course, Esther is not named Esther from birth, right? Esther's name from birth is?
Hadassah,
right? She gets this Persian name, Esther, but that's not her given name. All three of them are given these foreign names. There's an attempt to assimilate them. Let's go back to the story of the diet. Why do Daniel and his friends refuse the king's food? If they know that their lives could be on the line for this, right? It's not just the king's officer who's in danger if they don't eat the food, right? They're dead. So one could say it's about keeping kosher. It's a reasonable argument, except that that should be overridden by concern for one's life. Commentators suggest this wasn't about keeping kosher. This was about showing, you don't control me. I am not eating scraps off the king's table, like his pet. Right? You can't give me the scraps from the king's table and just expect me to say thank you. We're going to keep those to the side, we'll give them away, whatever it is, and we're going to take seeds instead. It's a statement that they're not going to assimilate into this new identity. And they consistently identify themselves as Jews, or I should say, Joseph and Daniel do. Right? Yosef, throughout his experience, is known as the Ivri, the Hebrew. Daniel is known as Yehudi. Esther, we're told specifically, the book makes a point of saying she doesn't tell anybody because Mordechai insisted she shouldn't say. It sounds like she wanted to, and Mordechai is telling her, don't. Which happens to work out well, but the general theme is one of retaining one's identity, and that's a second piece. Third piece, sanctifying God's name. I mentioned before that Joseph and Daniel credit their success in interpreting dreams to God. In the book of Esther, it's Mordechai who is the one who says it's all about God, right? When Esther says, I'm not so sure I can do this, I can go to the king, it's against protocol, and so on, right? Mordechai says to her, Jews will be saved somehow. You know, whether you're along for the ride is really what this is about. But either way, the Jews will be saved mimakom acher, from some other place. And they remain loyal to God. And Joseph and Daniel are the ones I'm really picking up on here. Joseph, when he refuses to the advances of the wife of Potiphar, says, I can't go along with you. B'chatati le'lokim. I would be sinning against God if I did. And Daniel says, I can't eat the food of the king, because if I did, yit ga'al, which would mean I would be repulsive if I ate your food. I have my loyalties. And so therefore he refuses. Everyone with me? Am I going too fast with this? Okay. And then, the fourth point. And to me, this is the biggest of all four, because it's one that people, I don't think, really are sensitive to. I think the first three points are sort of, if you were to ask somebody, what should you do when you're in the royal palace, this is the advice they would give you, right? Keep your faith in God. Keep your identity as a Jew, and sanctify God's name. But the fourth one is very important. And that is, despite resentment over your situation, over being stuck there in the palace against your will, look for ways to help the people around you. Look for ways to help even the government itself. And that we find in all three stories. You know, I mentioned before when we were talking about Joseph in jail, and I said that the story of his rise to power begins with anger, when the Pharaoh is angry at the butler and the baker, but I said that there's another root of it also. What is it that really begins Joseph's rise to power? Before that. You're right, but before that. Still in the jail. What happens before he interprets the dreams? He wakes up in the morning and he sees the butler and the baker who had their dreams the night before, and the Torah says, Vayarosam, he saw them, Vihinam Zoafim. Zaf is a term for being very upset, really disturbed and agitated. Well, it's more than despondent. We find Zaf used to express not anger, but agitation over something. I believe that it's fair to say that the word zaf reflects a real internal discord. Something is wrong. Something is bothering them. Yeah.
He's unsettled.
And Vayaro Sambihinam Zawafim, he sees that they are upset, and he goes to them and he says, Madua Pnechem Ra'im Hayom. He says, why are your faces weak or bad today? But what he means is, why are you upset? That's where his success begins. Because he sees people who are upset, and he goes over to them and he asks, what's wrong? Unfortunately, when we see people who are upset, there's sort of part of us that says, let me get away. You know, I have my own troubles. I don't need to get involved with that person's troubles. And Joseph could be excused for going the other way. He does have his own troubles. He's been sold into slavery by his brothers, right? He doesn't even know what his father is thinking at this point. There's a writer in Israel, Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun, who actually makes a very scary point. He asks the question of why Joseph doesn't write home. Over the years, after he's out of jail already and he's in the palace, why he doesn't write home to his father? And that's a question that various commentators have asked over the ages. But he gives a novel answer that I haven't seen in anyone earlier. He says, what's the last thing that Joseph knew of his father? What's the last thing? He sent them to his brothers. Joseph's got to be wondering, is this all a plot? Was my father in on this? A very scary thought.
He didn't have email.
Right. The net was down. Wi-Fi wasn't working in the Egyptian jail. They were underground. Whether I take that idea regarding Joseph and his father or not, the point is, he's been sold into slavery, and then he's been thrown into the prison. He could be excused for wanting to look the other way and not get involved in somebody else's troubles. But he doesn't. He goes out of his way to ask, what's wrong? And that leads to him interpreting their dreams, which leads to him getting his gig with Paro, and leads ultimately to his rise to become the viceroy, and that's through helping Paro himself. Right? There could have been no love lost between him and Paro either. He doesn't need to be the one to explain Paro's dreams. Daniel. Daniel actually gets in trouble for the help that he gives. You see, King Nebuchadnezzar has several dreams. But after the initial dream that Daniel has interpreted, later on there's another dream in which he sees an image of himself, basically, suffering a horrible punishment. The message of the dream is that he's going to lose his power, he's going to lose his mind, he's going to be wandering as a beast in the field. It's a terrible vision that Nebuchadnezzar has, and it's the humbling of this king. Daniel interprets the dream for him. But then he does more than that. Beyond interpreting the dream, he gives him advice. I highly recommend reading the book of Daniel. It's such a remarkable story. He gives him advice. He says, this is what I think you ought to do. Give tzedakah. If you give tzedakah, if you give charity, then all will then you will be able to forestall this punishment. And as the book records, he gives tzedakah for a year, And then after that, he becomes arrogant then again, and he says, I've got it all. And at that point, he is struck by the prediction of the dream, and he actually goes through this horrible phase. Another story for another time. But the point is, Daniel goes out of his way to give Nebuchadnezzar advice. Now, let me underscore just how weird this is. Nebuchadnezzar is the destroyer of the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. He is responsible for the deaths of thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Jews. He caused the mass exodus of the Jews to Babylon. That's how Daniel ended up in the palace in the first place. He is a brutal, vicious, cruel human being. Frankly, if Daniel comes to me as his rabbi and asks a shaila, he says, Rabbi, what do I do? The king had this horrible dream. I'm going to explain it to him, so I'll let him know what's in the dream, and then my job is done. I think I could also give him some advice that he won't have to suffer. Should I? Actually, I'd like to see you accelerate the dream if you could. I'd like to see him suffer sooner. He doesn't do that. He gives him advice instead for how to evade the consequences of the dream. It's really a scary thing. And the Talmud actually asks, what in the world did Daniel think he was doing? And it suggests he actually was punished for it. That it was wrong. And they try to give various justifications. Maybe when he asked Nebuchadnezzar to give charity, he meant for him to help the Jews who had been exiled, and that was the motivation, was to be able to assist the needy. But at its core, when you read the story itself, you realize that Daniel has gone out of his way, as Yosef did, right? Yosef with the butler and the baker, and Yosef with the king. He interpreted Pharaoh's dream, but then he added whipped cream. Right? He said, not only am I going to explain your dream, but here's how you can deal with the years of famine that are coming. You should store up all the grain and so on. Like, he gave him economic advice. He didn't have to do that, but he did it. And then, of course, we get to Mordechai and Esther, who saved King Ahasuerus from the plot of Bigtan and Teresh. And once again, Ahasuerus is a horrible human being. We talked about that already, whatever it was, half an hour, 40 minutes ago. Ahasuerus is a horrible human being. Maybe he should just let Bigtan and Teresh do their thing. Why does he need to get involved? Save this person who took out the vessels of the temple and used them at his, feast? A feast which, according to the Talmud, is itself celebrating the capture of the Jews? If they're going to kill him, that's their problem. His problem. That's not my problem. Why in the world is he getting involved? And the answer is, once again, reaching out to do. If you take a look at your sheets, two sources on this. Midrashim. Source number 12. We are compared to Chol Hayam, to the sand of the sea. The Midrash comments, Nimshalu Yisrael b'chol v'ha'umot b'sid. The Jews are compared to sand, the nations are compared to lime, and he quotes a verse from Yeshaya, from Isaiah, to that effect, v'ha'yu amim b'sifot sid. Well, if you've ever made a lime, you know you need sand in it in order for it to hold its consistency. If you haven't made lime, you can just trust me, or you can look it up on Wikipedia. If you do not put sand into lime, it will not endure. The nations cannot stand without Israel in their midst. Without Joseph, the Egyptians would have been lost with their famine. And without Daniel interpreting the dreams, aside from the help he gives to Nebuchadnezzar, if he hadn't interpreted the dreams, all of them would have been killed, all of the sages of Babylon. And then take a look at number 13, which puts us in the head of Mordechai as he's trying to figure out whether to do anything about this plot against the king that he's overheard. Amar, source number 13, he said, Yaakov bireches paro. Well, Yaakov blessed the Pharaoh, quoting the verse, Vayivarech Yaakov et Paro. Yosef gila lo. Yosef revealed the dreams, the meaning of the dreams, to Paro. Daniel gila le Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel revealed the secrets to Nebuchadnezzar. Av ani kein. So I guess I should do it too. And Vagel Esther HaMalkan, he told Queen Esther about it. So that what we see here is four different traits that are important to the Jew in the foreign palace. Keeping his faith in God, keeping his identity as a Jew, sanctifying God's name, and looking for ways to help the people around them, including the very government that has been so difficult and so hostile for us. Now, none of the Jews in foreign palaces are capable of bringing full redemption themselves. Right? When you think about the way these stories end, we don't get happily ever afters. The only one sort of is the Book of Esther. Right? What's the ending of Yosef's story? 210 years of slavery. Right? That's the prize. Because you saved the Egyptian economy, your family is going to come down here first for food, and then eventually to stay for a couple of centuries. Yeah. Well, how it gets cut down and why it gets cut down is actually a good... Yeah, that's a question of itself. But they end up as slaves. Daniel, out of that, exile. The Jews are still in exile after Daniel is done. As a matter of fact, his visions in the second half of his book predict extended exile, the exile that comes after the Second Temple. Esther? Well, you could make the argument, and certainly within the context of Midrash, we do make the argument, that the union of Esther and Ahasuerus leads to the birth of a king who will be friendlier and allow us to finish rebuilding the Second Temple. So there is that. But it's not immediate either, even there. And the point is, Al tivtechu bin divim, we don't trust in our princes. We don't trust in our Jews who are in their foreign palaces. They want to help, but ultimately the help comes from God. But what we do see is that Tanakh is presenting us with role models. We have people who are presented with similar personalities, similar elements of their lives. We talked about all the language of the beauty and so on. Similar plot elements in terms of the way that God acts, in terms of the role of anger, in terms of being given royal clothing. They perform similar actions, whether it's dream interpretation or saving the Jews from a threat, or whether it's acting to save the king and the empire. All their activities, they reflect each other. And the sages make these links even stronger than Midrashim, like the business of the seed diet that Esther has that's borrowed from Daniel, and so on. And what we learn from it are the traits that they had that we then ought to display for ourselves in our own positions in the foreign palace. Thank you very much.
I ask you a question.